alerts or been told one was issued about you. A birth alert was a message sent to a hospital by child welfare workers before your baby was born. If this sounds familiar, you may be eligible for compensation through the Birth Alerts BC class action. Visit birthalertsbc.ca or call 1-833-632-6557.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Thank you for your constant support. You help keep independent community radio alive.
Kwe.
Why EB snack seal?
Tan she.
Tanek e. Negad dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Kwe, Nindaluizi Pam Pometer. Hi, my name is Pam Pometer, and I'm your host for the Mi'kmaq episodes of Words and Culture. I'm a citizen of the Mi'kmaq Nation and a member of one of the First Nations that make up our larger nation. It's called Eel River Bar First Nation, but we call it Ugbaganjig, which really means where the Eel River meets the Atlantic Ocean, right at the Bay of Chaleur. To me, it's home. Nimitginin. Home. Today's show is something really special. Bernie Francis is not just a Mi'kmaq speaker, but he's an actual linguist who studies languages. He literally wrote the orthography for the Mi'kmaq language. I was so captivated by his stories that sometimes I forgot I was even hosting this show. I know you'll love him too. Here's my conversation with Bernie Francis. Kwe, hello, Bernie. Menwilleen, how are you?
Oh, Pam Willie. I'm also very flattered to be interviewed by you.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, not only am I happy that it's you, it's also that we get to talk about something amazing. There's always so many negative things in the media, but today we get to talk about the Mi'kmaq language. And I was thinking, who else? Who better to have on this show than someone who is a Mi'kmaq linguist? And I know lots of listeners will be thinking, yeah, okay, what is a linguist and what kind of training goes into it? Because certainly just because I can speak the English language, that doesn't make me a linguist.
Right. I had at the time, we're talking since 1974, I had a visitor that I had known for about a year prior to 1974, a good guy. He was originally from Akron, Ohio, and got some of his academic training in Alberta, and then he studied linguistics at University of Toronto. And so I met him, and what he was doing there, first of all, was a guy by the name of Gordon MacDonald. Gordon was from Member 2. So he met Doug Smith in Toronto. So Doug was explaining to him that he was ready to do his research for his dissertation for his PhD in linguistics. And but he was wondering, what to do with on. You know, Gordon said, why don't you try Mi'kmaq? At that time, it was Mi'kmaq, you know. And Doug took him up on it. But the only reason why he took him up on it is because he liked the sound Mi'kmaq. So anyway, Doug suddenly arrives. Well, not suddenly, but he finally arrives around 1973 in Member 2. And he gets a place. And so Doug had already at that time did a little bit of investigation on me. And because we had talked before, we were good friends, and he liked me, I liked him, you know. But one day he shows up in my house, sat down next to the kitchen table, and he pulls out these old documents that were written by a missionary priest in your area of the world.
Yeah.
So Doug brings these books that were written probably before 1938, around that time. So finally he said, I got a question for you. And I said, what is it? So he opened one of the books and he says, sit down and have a look at this. And when he opened it up in front of me, I said, well, that's in Mi'kmaq, looks like, I said. He said, well, can you read any of it? I said, no, no. Why can't you read it? I said, well, because, you know, I just never really learned how to read Mi'kmaq. He said, did you ever try? I said, no, never tried. So he said, have a look at it. So I looked at it, you know, and see what was there. I couldn't believe it myself that within few minutes, I was able to figure it out word for word. You know, so finally, to make a long story short, I sat there in front of Doug for about an hour going through. I became sort of hooked on what I was reading here. You know, it's all religious stuff or something or other. But the fact that I could read it was something else. I actually figured it out as I was reading it, you know. So then after some time, Doug is sitting there with that familiar smirk on his face that I used to notice when something would catch him, you know. So he said, have you ever considered studying linguistics? And I said to Doug, I said, you know, Doug, I probably would be if I knew what the hell it was. I couldn't even pronounce linguistics at the time, you know. So I said, he said, and he laughed, of course. So he explained it. He explained what linguistics was. And again, I felt kind of interested, you know, about what he was saying, even though I've never, at that point, I hadn't studied linguistics, though I was already doing work on the language. But as a court worker, I was running a court worker program for our people at the time, because I caught on that they were treated very badly in court, my own people. And the only way that I would have known that is I got a job with the John Howard Society.
I'm going to stop right there because what comes next is super fascinating. And yes, our conversation takes a bit of a pit stop. Bernie realized that Mi'kmaq people who were going to court were pleading guilty to all kinds of crimes, mostly misdemeanors, because they didn't understand the English language. The Canadian Bill of Rights at the time didn't specifically guarantee the right to a translator in court, but some of the court decisions developed such that it was considered part of the right to a fair hearing. Nowadays, of course, the right to an interpreter in court is protected in Section 14 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and that's a right that's critical to Indigenous language speakers, especially if their language is their first language.
Well, our people didn't know that.
No.
You know? So, of course, they wouldn't ask, because they don't know. And the judges knew that probably, but they didn't say anything at the time. So anyway, so when I saw this was going on, I said, my God, you know, this is not good. So I didn't really do anything at that time until one guy from Eskizoni came to me one day. This is before the court started, and we're out in the hallway, not exactly in the courtroom yet. And he says to me, come here, I want to talk to you. He was very excited. But he was telling me, he said, look, they're charging me with this and that. He said, I wasn't even around at the time, you know, so he was quite adamant about that. So I said, okay, what you do there, and we're speaking in Mi'kmaq the whole time. I said, go in there, and when the judge calls your name, you get up and you go in front of the judge, and the judge will read a charge to you. Whether you understand it or not, he'll read a charge. And then at the end of it, he's going to say to you, do you plead guilty or not guilty, Mr. Gugu? And you just say not guilty. And then later on, we'll have a look at it. Legal aid was just beginning at that time, by the way, at that time. So we're talking about 1971 or 1970. Mm-hmm. It was just beginning. There was only one lawyer in town. Fortunately, he was a good guy. And I had already introduced myself to him and told him the story. Yes, he said, bring them in, you know, meaning our own people.
Yeah.
So anyway, this guy, we're all sitting in a courtroom, and I had already told him what to do. And finally, his name gets called, and he goes up to the front. And the judge does exactly as I thought he would. He would read the charges, and then he turns to him. He said, what do you plead, Mr. Gugu? Are you guilty or not guilty? Guilty, he said. I said, what? I was ready to jump up and choke him.
Oh, my goodness.
So anyway, when... Of course, he's going to get 10 days or 15 days in jail, whatever it was, you know. And as he's going out the door, I left the courtroom and chased after him in the hallway. And I said, gee, what happened? I said, I told you to plead not guilty to these. Yeah, but he said, the way the judge was looking at me, and I didn't like standing there in front of people, you know. And that's typical of our people. That's typical of our people, you know. You kind of don't look at an elder directly in the face, you know what I mean? It's disrespectful, and it's almost like a kind of like animals, you know, who challenge one another, you know. It's a deadly eye contact. Well, he didn't want any of that. So he just, the fastest way to get out of there was to plead guilty. So he pleaded guilty, just like everything else. It was then that I went back home, and I sat down with the Union of Nova Scotia Indians leaders at the time, and I said, look, here's the situation. I explained everything to them, and I said, I'm damn angry, I said, because our people are just, it kind of reminds me of a conveyor belt.
Yeah.
Up, plead guilty, off to jail, and then that's it. So anyway, they understood, fortunately. So they said, well, what do you want to do? I said, we have to start some kind of a court worker program or something like that. And they said, yes, okay. Well, I said, will you help me write a proposal to the government? They said, yes, indeed, we will. Anyway, I think it was about a month. The notice arrived from the government. I opened it up. There was a check, $56,000, everything I asked for. So that's how we started. I started the court worker program at the time. And from that point on, Well, first, I visited a lawyer, and I said, you be ready for me, because I'll be bringing people in. All right. Mm-hmm. So for a little while, our people went to the courtroom, and then they would plead. Most of the time, they were still pleading guilty. So then I put the notice out, and we had what was called Micmac Magazine at the time. It's a little newspaper that came out every month. Roy Gould was the editor then. And so it came out, and I had a little notice in there that said, from now on, anyone that is charged with anything, plead not guilty and contact me. And I had my contact numbers there. And well, it started. The contact started, you know. And my late wife, she died a few years ago, but she said to me, why did you give them our number? They're calling us at 2 o'clock in the morning. 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, well, I said, unfortunately, I said, it's the way it is, you know, I have to deal with it. So suddenly everybody started to plead not guilty, our people, you know. Then before long, it got to the point where the prosecutors hated me. The judges hated me, and the RCMP, they sicked the RCMP on me on the weekends, just hoping that I would make these great grave mistakes on the highway or something, you know. And that is because suddenly the prosecutors had to work for their convictions.
What a story. Bernie was just 22 years old at the time, and he could already see the injustice that was harming our people. And that was all because of the colonizers' language was being used to effectively persecute Mi'kmaq people. All of that to say that Bernie's love of the language was really instilled in him with the defense of his people in court. But let's get back to the linguistics of the language.
To go back to Doug said to me, after we talked about linguistics and when he told me what it was, I said, yeah, I guess I wouldn't mind studying linguistics. I said, but where would I have to go? I said, I have a family here. He said, you don't have to go anywhere. He said, I'm the professor. I'm your teacher. And we started working almost immediately. I'll tell you, I absolutely fell in love with what I was learning at the time. Doug was an excellent teacher. And I just loved linguistics. I just it was like I took to it like a duck to water. Aww. And I just so enjoyed it. But it took about maybe 2 years before I got the lingo down well, you know, and because you're practically speaking another language for a while until you get on to what all of these terms mean and so on. So we started in 1974. because a man on the reserve who was an educator, his name was Peter Christmas. I call him the mastermind of what we were doing. He's the guy that gave us the mandate to come up with a writing system that's easy to learn for the children. And of course, at that time, you know, Pacific system was around, but that wasn't so easy to learn. There was too much guesswork involved. Mm-hmm. And then prior to Pacific, there was a missionary who published a dictionary. He was a Baptist missionary, Silas T. Rand, who published a dictionary in 1888. And so we looked at all the stuff. And we knew what the problems were with those orthographies. That's why they didn't catch on. So Doug said, well, he said, we'll have to do better. I said, mm-hmm. I guess we do. I said, because they're not going anywhere. Nobody's reading them or writing them. So we set to work. And when we were developing it, of course, we had to find out what is the sound system in this language. We had to find that out first. And so we worked, took every word, and we just conjugated it, took every noun and declined it, you know, figuring out the sounds, you know. And after about 3 years or something, we figured out that we had 27 distinctive sounds in the Mi'kmaq language. Now, compare that to English. English has about, depending on the dialect, because Newfoundland has 5 different dialects of English. And 2 of them, by the way, need a translator. That's how different it is. So let's say English has about 50, between 50 and 55 sounds. And so compared to Mi'kmaq, we only had 27 sounds. So once we figured out, okay, I think we pretty well have, you know, the sound system mapped out. Now we have to choose an orthography that represents that sound system. So I said, all right. So we began. And after about a year or so, we came up with an orthography, and it was my job to go out and test it on the various reserves. I would go to Wahmatgut, which is next to Bedeque, and I would test it out, and it would be going along, and suddenly someone would give me a word, and I said, oh, geez, you know, I don't know how to handle that. I said, all right, so back to the drawing board I would go, you know, and I would say to Doug, Doug, you know, it's not quite right yet. We have to do this. So Doug would work with me again, you know, and helping me out and teaching me at the same time. Before long, you know, after a couple of weeks, we'd come out, oh, yes, we know what's going on. Here's what we want to do with this. So this kept going on. I'd go, you know, we make changes and add a letter or something or delete a letter or something. And then we would, you know, do this for a while. After about maybe 4 or 5 times of testing them, finally in 1980, we knew at that time we had a polished product. And Doug thought about it and I thought about it. And I said, oh, my God, I think I know what this means. It means, I'm talking in my own mind at that time, Doug's going to leave me. Because we got to be such good friends. We're working in a small office. We're discussing language every day of the week. I wouldn't have got that at university, you see. I would have worked in 2 classes a week, and that would have been it. But mm-hmm. with Doug, every day, we were a steady diet of the Mi'kmaq language and the ins and outs and the, you know, it's almost like studying, what they call quantum mechanics. Yeah. You know, because we had to really dissect that language, you know, to find out what makes it tick. And finally, I felt I had gone back several hundred years. That gave me that feeling that, by God, you know, I think I have an idea about how our language sounded like way back when, you know, because. Yeah. Sometime after 1700s, particularly the letter of 1750, the language was quite a bit different at the time, and that was dictated to by a chief from Chapel Island Reserve, and Father Meyer, who was another missionary around, let's say, he arrived around 1734, and he stayed with us. I think he died in around 1763, but he worked on the hieroglyphic system and was not interested in teaching us the Roman alphabet at the time. And he said, when he was asked that question, he said, I don't want them, meaning us, to read anything else except biblical stuff and catechisms and things like that, you know. But anyway, I got to realize, okay, I have an idea about what our language sounded like back 300 years ago. And I think it's probably, you know, it's still pretty close. So, you know, that's what happened. And then, so I realized, okay, our language sounded a particular way. There's certain sounds that don't exist anymore, such as an SH, for example. That sound, you know, that doesn't exist in our language anymore. Like Sahamau, which is the word for chief, at that time would have been like Shugamau.
Oh.
See, that sound is completely gone. And then, of course, the letter R existed, you know, but it doesn't exist anymore. Anything that's an R in a, that comes into our language will assimilate to an L. Yeah, after time, you know, you kind of get a feeling about not just a linguistic knowledge, but a feeling about how words should be spelt and so on. Anyway, to make a longer story short, Doug left in 1980. He said, I feel pretty redundant now. And we said our goodbyes, and I missed him. But one day, he left me with something which I never did forget, because it was something crucial. And I don't think it would have happened if I wasn't so frustrated with the spelling of one word. We had a difficult time. So I said one day to Doug, I said, Doug, let's spell the damn thing this way. Let's spell that word this way. I mean, who the hell is going to care? Who's going to notice? So Doug turned around at the time and said to me, you never dictate to the language as to how it should be represented. You must allow the language to dictate to you. You know, now he may as well have been sitting with me for the next 40 years, because with that statement left with me, he took off, you know, and it was bothersome, that statement, but I stuck with it, because sometimes you get frustrated and you want to write in any old way, you know, just to get out of the frustration. But I never fell for that. In the end, I paid attention to what Doug had said at the time, and that statement continued to be my teacher, even though Doug wasn't around. You know, he left for greener pastures. My greatest fear was getting into some kind of a car accident at the time, because if I got killed, everything would have been down the tubes, right? All the work. So I was really afraid. So I called the Eskasoni Council, and I said, I'd like to start rudimentary techniques of reading and writing Mi'kmaq in Eskasoni. And I like to teach people how to read with this new system. But who I would need mostly are teachers who are teaching Native children in the big reserve of Eskasoni. And I want to make sure that they're confident enough where they could develop curriculum materials. They're the ones I need the most. And they understood right away. And they immediately contacted a few teachers. And then I started once a week. I went to Eskasoni for about 2.5 hours, teaching them this this new orthography. And it was so simple, because to people who spoke the language, it was absolutely simple. I mean, Doug and I followed what is known as the phonemic principle. That means for every one letter, there's one sound. And for every one sound, there's one letter, you know? Mm-hmm. Now, there's no such thing. I mean, nobody would come up with an orthography that has silent letters. I mean, what would that do? I mean, English has them, but it wasn't because they put them in. They were correct at one point. Like the word, let's take the word night, for example, N-I-G-H-T. Mm-hmm. Well, there's only three sounds to that, N-I and T, night, mm-hmm. You see? So therefore, you have G-H in the middle, which are silent. Why would they put them there? Well, they didn't. What happened was when the migration happened in Europe, right, and you get all of these people ending up around England, and there was a separation of 700, 900 years, naturally the languages will change. So the language did change in around Britain area, but they didn't change the orthography with it. So that is why night is still spelled N-I-G-H-T. But prior to it arriving in that area, it would have been nicht, that word for night. So in that respect, the G and the H are pronounced. Nobody would just put in silent letters for no good reason, you know. It just doesn't make any sense. So the teachers learned in that 10-week period, Everybody that was in that class, including non-teachers, picked up on the language quite easily. And sure enough, the teachers did exactly what I had hoped that they would do, and that's to start developing curriculum materials. And they went ahead. I was so proud and very happy.
I wanted to know one last thing from Bernie. So I asked him, if there was one thing people should know about the Mi'kmaq language, what would it be?
I totally relied on elders. It was their patience and their understanding that kept me going. Because, you know, first of all, I always mention Peter Christmas because it was Peter that was the brains behind it all. We were just the foot soldiers, Doug and I, you know.
Right.
And we had to go around and talk to people. But I really, going to people like in Member 2, there was Pauline Bernard, Frank Doucette, Carl Gould, you know, all these people that I relied on that I thought were very good speakers, and they are. And then Eskasoni, there's one lady that's known as Dr. Granny. Her name is Margaret Johnson, and Margaret and Wilfred Prosper. And then, of course, I went to New Brunswick, and I went to Listigouge, and I talked to elders there all over the place. So the elders from, let's say, the Maritime Provinces were, without them, none of this would have been possible, or it wouldn't have been possible in a way where I actually feel I have a well-rounded knowledge about our language, you know, from the elders to the young ones and so on. They were... Yeah. A tremendous, tremendous help, you know. And for payment, only one asked for payment, and that was Dr. Granny. She asked me for a pair of sheep-lined slippers after 25 years of work.
Do you see why Bernie Francis is so respective in Mi'kma'ki, our home Mi'kmaq territory? He has always put the love of our people first, even when it didn't always make him very popular in the non-Indigenous community. His work developing the orthography for the Mi'kmaq language is a real gift to all of us, and also a legacy for future generations that'll help ensure that our Mi'kmaq language will never be lost. My biggest takeaway is that it's never too late to learn my language. But that learning about the language and that cultural context is part of learning how to speak the language. Well, Aliog, thank you all for listening. I'm Pam Palmiter, and this is Words and Culture. Namultas, see you again.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dan King Sam.
Namaltis.
Ninwis Akaka Miku Kwakwal.
Kachunautano.
Wapamatin Mina.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Burning!
There we go. Okay.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hundreds of feet deep in the ocean, light fades to black, and a vibrant ecosystem comes to life. This is the ocean's twilight zone, a cold, dark place that's home to strange jellyfish and glowing squids, as well as plankton and countless fish.
It's really an amazing assemblage of animals that have adapted to these low light and cold conditions.
Chris Dorsett of the nonprofit Ocean Conservancy says these animals help regulate the Earth's climate by transporting planet-warming carbon deep underwater. The ocean absorbs a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Then tiny phytoplankton near the ocean's surface take up carbon as they photosynthesize and grow. Every night, creatures from the twilight zone swim to the surface to eat these phytoplankton and other creatures. Then they take that carbon back down to the deep, where much of it will remain. But Dorsett says the twilight zone is in trouble, as companies grow more interested in deep-sea fishing and mining. So he says it's vital that countries enact policies to protect it.
This area very much needs to be protected before activities begin that could really impact it and impact those values for society.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Speak up.